Hi, thank you for joining us for this conversation in our podcast series. This conversation, we're talking about the keys to the cycle of addiction and incarceration. My name is Christine Collins, and joining me for this conversation are Victor Primera, who has literally a lifelong history of struggle with addiction and incarceration, and is now working towards 6.5 years sober. And Erin Moyer, who is one of our clinicians with our Daily Bread Employment Center's Behavioral Health Clinic at the Falls Way. Erin, do you want to tell us a little bit more about your background and the work you do?
Sure, absolutely. I have worked with co-occurring disorders, which is people struggling with mental health issues and substance use issues, since about 2006. I've also worked in the Baltimore City Detention Center, which is the city jail. And I'm now working at the Falls Way Clinic.
Great. Thank you. Victor, you are, tell me again where you're from.
I grew up in East Baltimore, Baltimore City. I was born on Park Avenue down near Chinatown and basically lived in East Baltimore most of my life.
Okay. And you mentioned that there was a father figure in your life that was part of your abuse history. Your history, I have to warn people, is pretty horrific. You were abducted at the age of 8, and your abductor used drugs and alcohol to subdue you so that they could sexually abuse you. Is that right?
True.
Yeah.
That was the first incident.
Right. And then you were abducted again by that same individual a few years later?
Yes, 10 years old. And the first time I was kept for 3 days, and the second time 5 days, and then raped by a woman at 10 years old and caught gonorrhea and had to be treated at Mercy, and then abuse from my stepfather from 10 to 12 until I left my mother's supervision and moved in with somebody that became my grandfather.
That horrific kind of history of abuse at such pivotal ages in your life led almost, Erin, I'm tempted to say almost of course, to a history of disorder and addiction. By the time you were 14, Victor, you had overdosed on heroin. Is that right?
Yes, that was my first time. By the time I was 10 years old, I was smoking marijuana daily. 12 years old, I started sniffing cocaine because back then it was a myth. It wasn't addictive. 13 years old, I started intravenous drug use, and 14 years old, I had my first heroin overdose in Bronx, New York. Mm. Since then, I've had at least 5 or 6.
Mm. When was the first time, Victor, that you committed a crime that you were incarcerated for?
First incarceration was... Well, I was arrested. My first arrest was 20 years old or 21 years old in 1990. So that would be 27. I don't know. I was 22 or 21 when I did my first incarceration in Division of Correction. But before then, I was in and out of Baltimore City Jail for numerous charges.
So I'm going to pause with your story for a moment, Victor, and I'm going to
Sure.
shift to Erin, and I'm going to ask Erin, based on what you've heard so far, I know that Victor is not one of your patients. I want that to be clear. We respect all kinds of HIPAA regulations, et cetera, on these conversations. And Victor is telling his story at his freedom, and it is at his will, and he knows that. But I wanted to ask you how typical or atypical is this kind of history for the individuals that you may treat at the Behavioral Health Clinic at Falls Way?
Yeah, well, I want to honor Victor's story and say that Victor has been through a lot. So in that way, it's not typical. And to see that Victor is succeeding and living a life right now that seems pleasing to him is just awesome to hear, because that is not everyone's story. But yeah. people don't get addicted to drugs because it's fun and they want to. There's a reason, there's something that happens typically, and people will start using and then they can't stop. They've done studies where rats are drinking water that has either cocaine or heroin in it, and they will drink till they overdose. They don't stop. So there's something that happens in our bodies and our minds that keep us addicted to them.
From your perspective, how many factors, I know that this is really complicated, so I don't want to oversimplify it, but I would imagine that there might have been three factors for Victor, one being his youth, and who knows what sort of biochemistry is adjusting at that point, but also trauma and self-medication.
Absolutely.
And also maybe a tendency toward addictive behaviors at any rate. Is that a reality in clinical care, or is that a myth? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. We see trauma to some degree in almost every case. It's just that people have difficulty recognizing it as trauma in their own life. So I don't know, for instance, if Victor was able to recognize that, probably I'm assuming because it was to that extent. But yeah, we go through trauma and then we have to find a way to cope with it. And if drugs and alcohol are something that's already in our environment, if it's part of what's happening in our family or it's part of what's happening in our neighborhood, it's what we're going to latch onto because we're trying to find a way to deal with this terrible thing that's happening in our mind and our body.
Mm. Victor, after that first incarceration, when you were 21, when you were released, what was life like for you?
I lost hope because I thought I wouldn't been able to find a job. I returned back to my old neighborhood, my old friends, and I thought I owed myself something or deserved something because I did make it through the criminal justice system alive. And I guess, as they say in the society, I earned an honor badge or something, but it was basically just returning back to my old friends, the old neighborhood. I lost hope, and I went back to what I knew best, was using to cope with reality and to ease the pain of my situation.
And what, if you don't mind my asking, and it's okay if you don't want to answer this, but what kinds of things would you do in order to sustain that habit or that addiction?
Well, in the beginning, I tried to work, and I did work many jobs, odd and end jobs, roofing, construction, different landscaping, but it wasn't enough money to support my habit because by that age, my addiction was, or my intolerance was so strong, I was going through hundreds of dollars every night, so I started stealing. Breaking into cars was my main thing. I've never been a violent person. So I did things where there wasn't people involved, even though it raised people's insurance, car insurance, and wasn't normal. I broke into cars mainly to steal stuff and most of the time the people left the cars open or left the keys in them. So basically thefts, burglaries, stolen cars, stealing from my family. Well, I stole from everybody in my family because they were the closest to me.
What did that feel like for you?
It made me feel bad. I felt disgusted. I felt, ashamed. I lost pride in myself, pride in being a good son, and I was married because I got married at 16, and I think I was living with my second wife at that time. So I couldn't have been a good husband. I couldn't provide for my family because I wasn't in the right frame of mind. It was all about getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. Sometimes I would leave out 10 o'clock at night and walk around breaking into cars till 6 in the morning. maybe 30 or 40 cars a night just to have enough to use that night and have something to get me started for the next day.
Aaron, I feel like what we're hearing from Victor is not only a cycle of addiction and crime, but a really deep hole to be in emotionally and psychologically. How common is that when we're talking about people who are dealing with chronic addiction?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think it really highlights too, Christine, this whole idea that addiction is a disease. And what Victor was doing, breaking into cars and whatever else might have been happening, is a symptom of the disease. Your addiction needs to keep living. So it makes you do things that you wouldn't typically do. And then you feel terribly guilty about them. And then how do you manage the guilt? You manage it by using, because that's what's right in front of you.
So Victor, when was the next time that you returned to incarceration?
That was 1990. I think I went back in 1991. So I might have stayed home maybe 6 to 9 months. And until I caught another charge and wind up going back again.
And how long was that stint?
It was 1 year I did at the jail, because I started 6 months in a day. Then I had a year. Then I had 2 years. Then it went to 3 years, 3 years, 3 years, 6 years, 2 years, and then my last was a 10-year sentence.
And this was all because why? Were these the same kinds of crimes that you were committing? Was it always theft, and were they escalating the sentence because you were a repeat offender, or were there other kinds of situations happening, if you're willing to share that?
I also had 3 drug charges, simple possession. I think because my record started getting bad, I mean, more and more charges, but also I would have more charges. I might have had 1 charge in the beginning. One time I had 16 charges, 10 in the city and 6 in the county. The 1 6-year sentence was in Virginia. They don't have parole. And the charges in Virginia are different than Maryland. So it was, the penalty was stronger. Mm. So, and it just kept getting worse and worse. My disease kept progressing and getting worse and worse. And even if I wanted to stop, I couldn't stop, because I didn't know how to stop. And like I said before, I lost hope. I mean, I didn't have nobody to help me. Back then, there wasn't no support system for people leaving prison and trying to get help or housing or funding or anything to help you. You left prison with $25 of your money that you saved during the time, and they put you back out in the street. And that was the way it was. It was up to you to fend for yourself. So I went back home. Luckily, I had a good wife, and she accepted me back, but my addiction just kept getting worse and worse, and I wound up keep going back to prison. Mm-hmm. It kept me in a cycle, a vicious cycle that I didn't know how to change.
Aaron, you know, people often hear these kinds of stories about individuals like Victor who have this chronic repeat offender to support what people think of as a habit, you know, situation. What do you say to people who don't understand that cycle? How do you help people who have never been there understand what that is clinically?
Yeah, I think it's understanding really from someone's personal story, like Victor. I mean, I'm sure part of what was his story, but he hasn't gone into detail about, is like these 3-month stints that he's doing in the city jail. You get released, you don't know when, you don't know where you're going to go, and you have no job, and you have no money, and you literally have no bus fare to get anywhere that you might stay that night. And then you're supposed to find a job, and then you got to report to your PO within 24 hours. and you have to give a clean urine and all these things, like even in the first week when you get out, all these barriers, we call them invisible bars. You know, you can't get a job, you can't get housing because they'll discriminate against you because of your record. So many barriers that just make it easier to just use to deal with the pain of that. And then you end up back in the jail.
Victor, how similar does that sound to your experience?
Very true. Everything Aaron said was true. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, it's hard to explain. I wanted so much to stop and change my life, but it was no way to do it. Even if I wanted to change or stop, I just couldn't. Once the cycle of addiction, especially heroin, is a physical disease and your body craves it, and if you don't use, your body is sore and it's hard. And like I said, jobs might have gave me a job, but it was the most low-paying job that I could get. It wouldn't pay for, you know, support any of my bills or food and everything. So you lose a lot of hope, you know, for the future. I didn't want to become an addict, but it was the only thing that I knew how to survive, you know.
Yeah.
I'm very emotional, so if I start crying, don't worry about it.
It's okay.
I just used to escape from reality because I didn't know why certain things happened to me. And it just, like I said, it just progressed. I went from marijuana. I just kept progressing to other drugs that eased the pain more than what I did in the beginning. And only one people that accepted me was other addicts. You know, my family loved me because they had to love me. Because I was part of the family, but, you know, I never intensely meant to hurt anyone, you know.
Yeah. Victor, what was the turning point for you? When did things brighten? When did things start to get better for you?
Well, my last incarceration, the last time, 2013, I came home from prison and I used when I came home, because I came home, I had $50 in my pocket, and all I knew, I went back to East Baltimore with my friends and I used, and I wind up sleeping in their chair once the money was gone, and I went out and hustled, went out and did some crimes, and I knew if I kept going, I would end up in prison. So I went to Johns Hopkins and went into a detox, which led me to the Helping Up Mission. I stayed there for 3 to 4 months. But at that time, my grandfather was suffering from, who wasn't my legal grandfather or biological grandfather. He was the one that took me in at 12 years old and treated me like, but he was suffering dementia and Alzheimer's and asked me to come home to help take care of him. And I moved in with him and took care of him and stayed clean maybe close 6 to 9 months. And where he lived at in the Govins area, York Road and Woodburn, I was going to the store and I wind up seeing people selling drugs, and something, urge kicked up in me, and I started using, and once I started using, I couldn't stop. I tried my best to still take care of my grandfather and everything, and fed him and did what I could for him, but in the long run, I wind up, my addiction got worse, and I wind up started committing more and more crimes. And in the end, I end up with 4 cases, 21 charges, and was facing 70 years. And when I went to court, I accepted a 10-year plea agreement with the option of going to, it's called 85, 8, 8, 505, 8, 507. It's the Mental Health and Hygiene Act. And I had to do 2 years incarceration and come back before the judge and got evaluated for the program and was accepted and approved. I wind up doing 3 years in prison and was released to the Gardensia program in Park Heights. It was called New Vision of Hope. It's co-occurring program for mental health and addiction. And I was on mental health medications. I can't remember exactly when. Well, I mean, which meds? I think Paxil and maybe Elavil or something to help with the stress and mental health issues. I've seen a therapist. I did my 6 months there and was ready to be released. But in my mind, well, let me go back a little bit. When I got incarcerated for the charges, I was sent to central booking. And at that time, I seen a lawyer and I explained my situation, my problems were due to my addiction. And she asked me if I wanted to go into this program at BCDC called the ACCEPT program, Addictions, Corrections, and Treatment Substance Abuse Program. And I said, yes, I mean, that was my problem. So I went there and I stayed in that program 10 months. And because I knew as soon as I got incarcerated why I was there, because of my addiction and committing crimes, and I needed help. So, and I left my grandfather home and I just felt so bad and I couldn't do nothing about it. And I knew I had to make a decision at that time that to change. If I didn't do it, nobody was going to do it for me. So, and I went through the process of the court system and got the 10 years. And luckily I made it to Gardensia. And from there, when it was time for me to ready to leave, because my grandfather died March 30th of 2015 due to the results of his illness. He left me a few dollars, and I know that if I would have went back into the streets, I would have been overdosed or I would have ended up with a new sentence. So I decided from there to research Catholic Charities, the employment program they had there. And I went to Catholic Charities, Christopher Place Employment Academy, and I stayed there a year and I just kept striving from there. You know, I had to make a decision because I was getting older and I didn't have no other options. If I didn't do it, nobody else would. Society don't owe me nothing and society doesn't change. You have to change around society. And what they taught me, I'm a member of a 12-step program, but they say anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. So I'm not for sure if I could say that, but I'm a member of a 12-step program who taught me different things. You know, don't pick it up. It can't get in you. Take one day at a time. Certain cliches that they use, KISS, keep it simple, stupid, you know. I got a sponsor. I got a home group. I did what they told me to do. The main thing was change people, places, and things. The people, because they were still doing what they were doing. The places, because that kicked up triggers in me and the things that I did. Instead of going to a convenience store to buy a pack of cigarettes, instead of going to a liquor store, go to a convenience store. You know, if I had urges and stuff like that. So that was the main thing for me. So... And I had to learn to love myself because while incarcerated, I had found out I had hepatitis C. So I took the old treatment interferon and it made all my hair fall out. So I'm completely bald. So I had to look in the mirror every day, but I had to learn to love myself from within, you know. It doesn't matter what other people think, is how I think about myself.
Victor, what you're describing, thank you so much for the openness. I know that you say that you're used to telling these stories, but I also know that every time you tell this story, it's really painful and hard. And I want to acknowledge the grace that you offer when you share this story for other people's benefit.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you're willing to share this. And Erin, you know, you hear so much that sounds so much like what a clinical evaluation would yield in a case like Victor's. What I'm struck by, though, are the courage that it takes every day to make a better choice when you've kind of lost everything that you have. Can you describe a little bit about what happens psychologically when someone is trying to turn that corner from addiction to become sober and find self-sufficiency? I know there's a lot.
There is a lot. And you know, the ability to persevere, and you use the word courage, you really have to muster that up. And in order to be able to do that, doesn't that suggest that you really need people around you that are helping you to pull that out of yourself, that are encouraging you in that? So it really requires an ability to reach out and ask for help to a certain extent. And when you're feeling guilty and shameful, that's the last thing that you want to do. So I think that there's something that happens with that within a person where they say, I've seen this, I keep doing the same thing, and I keep ending up in the same place, whether it's jail, whether it's treatment, whether it's homeless on the street, and I know something needs to be different. And they somehow, I've seen time and time again, are in some way reaching out to another person. So they're accepting help that's offered, or they have family around them, or they have a treatment professional who's there, who can help to make them feel empowered to make those really, really difficult changes day after day after day. I mean, it's one foot in front of the other, as Victor's saying. He has to choose to go to his meetings. He has to choose to go to work every day. He has to choose not to pick up. There's that sounds exhausting, right? That choice point over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And you have to have support. And you, like Victor said, you have to believe that you can do it. Love yourself enough to do it.
Yeah. And that in and of itself, I mean, some of us know how hard it is to learn to love yourself, even when you don't have a chronic addiction and you haven't been through all of the things that Victor has described going through in his life. You know, we know that opioids are sort of the I want to say the spotlighted drug right now. Heroin has long been a scourge of society. That's not new. We have begun to understand in the last several years the impact of prescription drugs. Erin, how many, and I don't know if you have the statistic in front of you, but how many individuals currently in the criminal justice system might have the kind of addiction experience and history that Victor has shared?
Yeah, so they say, and this is just a federal prison statistic, so it's not pretrial like the city detention center, and it's not state prison, but they think that about 65% of people who are in the federal prison system have an active substance use disorder.
Wow.
Which means, I would guess, I don't know the questions that they ask, but that they've used within the past year and they consider it to be a problem.
And how is it possible? I want to go back a little bit because it's something that I wonder if people are wondering about as they listen. How is it possible for someone like Victor to be incarcerated for some length of time and not inherently break their addiction by virtue of not having access to use? I'm assuming, Victor, that you did not have access to use while you were incarcerated.
Well, if for somebody that hasn't been there, in prison, you can find anything you want. Mm-hmm. If you have the right money to pay for it. So there is options. If you want to use, you can use. Even if it's making homemade wine in there. They have Suboxone. They have heroin, cocaine, marijuana, anything. What you call that stuff? Artificial stuff that they smoke. K2. They have anything that you want. You can find it. So it's, and I have used, and DOC back in 93 was the last time I used in prison. But there's options. People just don't know that.
Thank you. So naive of me to make that assumption, right? That you would not have access to use. But you say 93 was the last time that you used when you were incarcerated. And you have been incarcerated Yes. in the time since then. So Aaron, clinically, how is that possible that an addiction can endure for so long without use that a person gets driven to use again as soon as they are released?
Well, I think there's a few factors that play, and Victor, correct me if I'm wrong. I think that the access is more difficult. It's there, but it's not right in front of your face, and it's not as easily accessible. And you're in a totally different environment where you're stressed in different ways than you are when you're in the community. I think a bigger part of it perhaps could be like, you're in this different environment, you've been through all this, you know that you have to sit and do some time, and people really fantasize and dream about how things are gonna be different when they leave, right? So like, they may get closer to their family by writing letters, having phone calls. Think like, when I get out, I'm not gonna do it again. I would imagine that's typical. But then you get back out, and again, like I explained before, it's not like you had expected. Well, or maybe you know that it's not going to be like that, but you get out and it's extremely stressful and you have limited resources. You're back in that same environment and it's just like clockwork. It can very easily happen again. I think Victor said earlier too, when he was talking about his grandfather, that he was in the neighborhood and he saw the drug dealers and something clicked. It's always lying dormant and it can very easily be triggered. So you go right back into that environment and it would be very easily triggered and very easy to go right back to if you don't have the supports that you really need, which is usually the case. Mm.
So Victor, I mentioned at the beginning, you are now coming up on 6.5 years sober.
Yes.
Congratulations. That's an everyday, every hour victory. I know you don't live in Baltimore, but you do work in Baltimore.
Yes.
So describe a little bit how your life has changed since your last release from incarceration. Describe a little bit about how things are going for you now.
First of all, I would like to say that at least 10 of my friends have died since I've been home due to direct result of addiction and fentanyl overdoses. My best friend just OD'd May 15th, and he had the same amount of clean time as I did. And like Aaron was saying, something must have just set him off because I was just with him and he used one time and it killed him. Far as me just being home, is my whole life has changed dramatically. Going through Christopher Place, the director gave me an opportunity to go on a job interview, and I got the job and started February 12th, 2018. I'm still at the company. I'm a valued employee. I work. I make a pretty good pay compared to $1 a day in Hagerstown prison system. So I bought a new car. I got married September 25th, 2018. My family loves me and respects me. They can depend on me for financial support or just support me being there, taking my mother to a doctor's appointments. I have a beautiful wife. My I can say this, my wife may drink a beer, but it don't affect me because I explained my addiction to her. I told her I don't drink, you know, I said I used to, and I said, if you want me to stay the good husband that I am, don't offer, you know, so. My life has changed dramatically. I bought a brand new car. A dope fiend like me that never had no credit. And like I said, I come to work every day. I live in Falls Church. I just switched shifts. So I get up at 8:00. I leave Virginia by 9:00. I get to Baltimore by 10:00 and I start my shift at 11:00. So it's hard work, but it gave me a chance and opportunity to better myself. I'm clean and sober. My sobriety date is April 29th, 2014. And even though some of my time was incarcerated, like I said, I had the option to use in prison or not to use. And I decided not to use. I went in every program I could. I went to 12 steps meetings there. Everything I could. I had to change my mentality. I had to change my thinking, my behaviors. And like Aaron said, we make all of these, or we think about all these fantasies, what we're going to do, or plans when we get out, and then society or reality smacks us in the face. So I had to really put my feet down and decide that I wanted to change and do the necessary steps. I had to do what the 12 steps told me, get a sponsor. I had to rely on people, like Aaron said. I had to be around people that wasn't using, that who have decided to change, who were doing the necessary work. Listen to positive information instead of negative information. You know, I think just getting a chance to prove myself. You know, I'm not the sharpest tack in the box, but, you know, I try to learn each day. And my main thing is I still have friends out there using, but they're just, I know what they're doing and I stay away from them. You know, I might speak, but I keep going. Because that's not my life today, you know?
Yeah.
I might have almost 6.5 years, but I'm trying to make it more every day. I go to programs and I talk to others who are in addiction, and I just tried that there is hope. There is hope. And,
yeah.
You know, I stopped taking psych meds. For me, it worked. For some people, it doesn't, because some people have bipolar. They have other things that are more severe that they need to be on medication. For me, it worked out that I just rather off. I didn't want to be on nothing. And now I wake up in the morning, I hear the birds, and I love it. And you know, it's beautiful.
And you still work with clinicians and therapists who help you determine the best course of treatment for you, right?
Yeah, yes. I still go to Catholic Charity. I still talk to the counselors. I still talk to my counselor and my therapist at Gardenza regularly. And I still go to my meetings when they're open up due right. to this virus. So,
Aaron, what so do you... I'm sorry, Victor. Aaron,
no,
what do
you go on.
Aaron, what do you think are some of the most important things for people who don't have this kind of experience to understand about the individual who is going through this kind of an experience?
Yeah, I think the best way to really understand this is to get to know somebody who struggles with it. And there are so many people who struggle that you don't even know that is their struggle. So that's the first thing I could say. And then I would really recommend that you try to see it as, like, you know, this whole old school model of it's like a moral issue. People choose to use that. Really, we really need to look at current research and realize that addiction is a disease. And when you have this disease, it makes you do things that are outside of your character, as they often say. And it's very, very hard to just quit. There's so many things need to be in place. You have to have so many resources, and you need to continue to persevere. And this is a daily and moment by moment struggle. So to kind of put yourself in that person's shoes can help you to understand just a tiny bit of what they might be going through.
Yeah. Victor, what do you wish that people understood about you in those years that you were using and breaking into cars and winding up in prison over and over? What do you wish people knew about you?
Well, the first thing I would say is people would always say, why don't you just stop? And like Aaron said, you just can't stop. It was no stopping. Once the obsession and compulsion to use sets in, there's no stopping. And then there wasn't no stopping for me besides going to jail. That was the only thing stopped me. I mean, I pray to God, I thank God for that I didn't hurt nobody or wasn't a violent person, you know, and I just want to know people that, you know, I'm a loving and caring person. I just, you know, I never asked to be an addict, but I turned out that way. And that's why I try to give back what is freely given to me. I try to help others. And like I said, I can't change society. I can change myself and try to help another sick and suffering addict. And even on my job, there's a couple people in recovery, and I stay close to them. I talk to them, and I just want people to know that, you know, that addiction is, I consider it is the disease. It's a mental health issue. It's, we need, addicts need help. You know, it's not a switch you can turn on and turn off, you know, with maybe proper treatment, understanding, that it can get better, and you can recover one day at a time. It's not going to happen overnight. You know, the person has to change, and they have to have the correct or proper treatment to get better.
Victor Primera, thank you so much again for sharing your story, for sharing your experience, for being so open with us in hopes of your own healing and helping other individuals to heal. We wish you absolutely the best of luck for every hour and every day of your continued recovery. We're thrilled to hear that you are stable and home and married and working. We should know that Victor has been talking with us from basically the parking lot of his job so that he could make sure that he would be there on time today. So we appreciate you arranging your schedule. Erin Moyer with our Daily Bread Employment Center Behavioral Health Clinic at Falls Way, thank you so much for your time and your expertise. I know it's been a very busy time for you as well. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
We do have more conversations about medical and or mental and behavioral health, including substance use disorders, available through this podcast and through our website, cc-md.org. Thank you all, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.